So this evening I wanted to talk about compassion and to give you a little bit of it, of the historical context of compassion in the Buddhist tradition, but also to speak about the practice and the cultivation of compassion in our lives. I wanted to start by reading to you one of the translations of the Bodhisattva vow. It says, though the many beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Though greed, hatred, and ignorance rise endlessly, I vow to end them. Though the Dharma is vast and fathomless, I vow to understand it. Though Buddha's way is beyond attainment, I vow to embody it fully. Now, this vow is recited in temples and monasteries and by individuals on cushions around the world on a daily basis. And what the vow is doing, it is reaffirming in people's hearts and minds really the essence of a meditative practice and the essence of a spiritual path. Now, sometime around the first century AD in northern India, or what is now probably Afghanistan, one of the most graceful and powerful texts in the Buddhist tradition was composed in Sanskrit, and it came to be known as the Lotus Sutta, the Lotus Discourse. And the central theme in this discourse is the portrayal of a powerful and boundless compassion, which is said to be the embodiment of a liberated mind, a compassion that pervades all corners of the universe to relieve pain and anguish and suffering wherever it touches, wherever it shines. Now, the Lotus Sutta was translated into Chinese. It's estimated around 400 AD. And at that time, the name and the figure of Kuan Yin appeared in the Buddhist tradition. And this is one of the images of Kuan Yin. And prior to that time, certainly in the Theravadan tradition, although compassion was so emphasized as being one of the pillars along with wisdom of the path, it had never really been spoken about in the oral tradition as a kind of almost like a path in itself that held all paths. And when Kuan Yin appeared, compassion in the Buddhist tradition took on much more of a kind of central place, a cultivation, as much of a cultivation and as equally as significant a cultivation as the cultivation of wisdom. Now, Kuan Yin has then reappeared in a number of different forms over centuries. Portrayed in a variety of different ways. Sometimes you see Kuan Yin under the name of Avalokiteshvara. The most familiar way that we see Kuan Yin is when Kuan Yin is depicted as a feminine presence. And often sitting very much like this, with a kind of serene face, a graceful body, outstretched arms, eyes usually open. embodying a kind of warm, embracing, receptive presence. Now, she's often portrayed seated on a lotus, like this, and the lotus is the symbol of the deepening and the flowering of the heart and mind. And very often in one hand she's portrayed holding a book of discourses or a book of suttas, which is meant to depict the compassion's roots being in the understanding of emptiness. And in the other hand, she's often portrayed as holding a vase. It's a symbol of the bottomless pouring out of love and compassion. Now, over centuries, other kind of images, other manifestations have appeared in different cultures. Sometimes in Chinese Kuan Yin, she's portrayed holding a willow branch. And the willow is the symbol of being able to, the capacity to bend before the most fierce storms and winds of life. Yet the willow branch also portrays or represents a certain resilience, the ability to bend, yet also to be able to come back upright without being broken. And the weeping willow, sometimes in Chinese culture, is used as almost a synonym for Kuan Yin's compassionate care for the ills of the world. Now sometimes Avalokiteshvara, and you may have seen this image before, where Avalokiteshvara is portrayed with 1,000 arms and hands spreading out in a great circle, and in the center of each hand is an eye. And the eye is said to be a symbol of the constant awareness of suffering and the all-embracing compassion. Now, another portrayal of Kuan Yin, which we hardly ever see, is when Kuan Yin is portrayed or depicted as an armed warrior, coming with a multitude of weapons, almost like a medieval fighter with crossbows and thunderbolts and spears and arrows and shields. And that portrayal is yet another side of compassion. There is the receptivity, but the warrior portrayal symbolizes the commitment to protect life and to uproot the causes of anguish. So she is protectus, protecting, guarding, and also fearless. Sometimes Kuan Yin is represented in a male form. And I think all of these different portrayals of Kuan Yin, they're not meant to be an invitation to create this sort of ideal of compassion or this distant aspiration that is projected into the future. But much more, these different portrayals really are an invitation to appreciate the different faces of compassion. That compassion is not something that is one-dimensional, but that it has all of these different aspects, which include, of course, the wisdom element. Now, sometimes I know people say that in the Buddhist tradition, which sometimes feels a little austere, you know, and kind of a hard labor type of discipline, some people say they feel very, very drawn and very attracted to the kind of very gentle, serene, nurturing aspect of Kuan Yin. But I think it is also so important to remember that in this teaching, compassion, the receptivity of compassion is balanced by its fearlessness and at times its ferocity. this wholehearted engagement with the end of suffering. It's almost as if the kind of agency and the receptivity are like different dimensions or different aspects of one whole, and both of them are necessary. Now, central, you know, I think we often think of compassion as a kind of feeling. And I know all of us in our own experience have had moments when compassion is something that very spontaneously and very naturally arises. But in this teaching, in this tradition, compassion is not a feeling as such. It is a commitment, it is an intentionality, it is also a cultivation. And very central to profound compassion is the commitment to the end of suffering and sorrow in all its forms, which is equally a commitment to ending the causes of suffering and sorrow in all their forms, both inwardly and outwardly. Now, it is said that compassion, the genuine flowering of compassion, is rooted in a profound understanding of emptiness, the emptiness of all formations. And yet, even in that understanding of emptiness, compassion is very much a path of engagement. It is an unconditional relatedness and engagement with the very real world of people and events who do suffer. The very real world of loss, of greed, of anger, of hatred and fear. Now, in the Diamond Sutta, it's a quote. Are you all familiar with the term bodhisattva? In the Diamond Sutra, there's a quote that says, "Any bodhisattva who undertakes the practice of meditation should treasure one thought only. Understanding perfect wisdom, I will vow to liberate all beings from the wheel of suffering and sorrow. And yet, when vast, unthinkable myriads of beings have been liberated, truly no being has been liberated. Why? Because no bodhisattva, who is a true bodhisattva, entertains such concepts as self or other. Thus, there are no sentient beings to be liberated and no self to attain perfect wisdom." Sounds like rather a confusing statement, doesn't it? What do you do with that? What do you do with that? But I think this apparently kind of paradoxical statement is in many ways really meant to challenge us. And it's meant as, it's an invitation that illustrates that the powerful marriage of understanding the nature of emptiness and yet being fully present in the world of form and in the world of beings who do suffer and experience pain and anguish. Now, the bodhisattva in the Buddhist tradition is not an idealized figure who inhabits some other realm, but rather the classroom of the bodhisattva and the classroom of compassion, of course, is in this life. As Reb Anderson, he put it in a wonderful way, he said, "Buddhas don't sit in the suburbs of suffering. They sit downtown." And the classroom then of compassion in this life is both understanding the causes and the end to sorrow, because I think all of us in our own lives and on a personal level know that we don't come to the end of sorrow and we don't come to the end of struggle through wishful thinking or through pretending. And that if we are to come in our own lives to the end of sorrow, the end of struggle, then somewhere in this process we need to understand the causes. We need to understand the causes. And for me, one of the great gifts of this teaching is that it rather takes, you know, the accident and the mystery out of this life. You know, we can sort of feel, you know, have you ever been in a situation, you know, you end up in some terrible mess of chaos or, you know, some great storm of thinking or emotion, and you come out the other end and you think, how did that happen? You know, how did I end up there? And it can feel like a mystery, it can feel like an accident. And yet what this teaching really invites us to understand is that this is actually not an accident. This is a process which can be understood, which can, and in the understanding, find the path to the end of struggle and anguish. This is so central to compassion, that it is this life in which the mind and the heart of the bodhisattva is really born. I'm sure that we would all agree that anyone can be compassionate from a distance. That we can all kind of overflow with compassion when we're undisturbed. When we're flattered and supported. But true compassion isn't forged at a distance. It is forged really in the fires of conflict and pain and sorrow. I know in the early years of my practice, when I, you know, had this rather idyllic life, in some ways idyllic life, on a Himalayan mountainside, you know, with a wonderful teacher, you know, I didn't have to pay a mortgage, you know, or didn't get bills in the mail, nobody knew where I was. You know, and I would sit there and have all these teachings on compassion, you know, and I would feel this boundless, overflowing compassion sitting on the mountainside looking down on India. You know, and then I realized one time I had to go to Delhi, you know, for some business, and I got on a bus, and this person sort of was groping me, and I just hit him. And it might have been okay if I hit him mindfully and compassionately, but actually I didn't at all. I just hit him. You know, and that was actually when it really so came home to me that, you know, compassion was not a feeling, that there was so much letting go needed to really come to that place where maybe I could be upright in the midst of difficult situations, respond to them appropriately, but not be so caught in this kind of impulsiveness of anger and reactivity the moment that I felt slightly threatened. You know, Shantideva, who was one of the great, great teachers of the past, he said, whatever you are doing, ask yourself, what is the state of my mind? With constant mindfulness and alertness, accomplish good. This is the practice of the bodhisattva. We are, I'm sure, all so very, very mindful of the urgency and the tremendous need for the cultivation and the embodiment of compassion in our world. Because there is a sorrow which at times feels bottomless. And to respond, we are asked to be present, to understand the causes of suffering wherever it arises. And it's not about saving someone. It's not even feeling an obligation to help others. But I think it is really, partially really the open-hearted willingness to probe beneath the surface of pain and to bring suffering to an end. Nyingma Rinpoche, again, one of the great Tibetan teachers, he said, long accustomed to contemplating compassion, I can no longer see a difference between myself and others. I'm sure that we can all appreciate that there is a kind of universality to the experiences of greed and anger and fear and rage and despair and frustration. I know sometimes when we are in the midst of any of those emotions, any of that suffering, we can feel so convinced and so sure that no one has ever experienced what we're experiencing. And yet there is no pain that we experience that has not been experienced before and will be experienced again by another or others in different times or places. Now this does not in any way lessen or diminish our own suffering, but more and more I think we come to understand the capacity of the human heart. You know, the capacity of the human heart to know pain, to know joy. You know, a dear friend of mine, her child died very suddenly. And she said in the aftermath of the baby's death, she said she felt more isolated and alone than she had ever felt in her life. And she said her anguish was made worse by her reluctance to impose her pain on others. So as time went by, you know, she would give the appearance of coping. Even though she said that she felt her grief was bottomless and endless. And she said a turning point for her was actually when she found a group of bereaved parents who would meet together without any agenda to heal or to fix or to get over, but where there was simply the space to listen and to be received. And she said she would listen to one story after another, one broken heart after another. And she said for that, it was that alone, her capacity to see her grief reflected in the eyes of another, that allowed the healing to begin. Now, so much of this sorrow and pain in this life, actually, some of it comes from events, but I think much of the sorrow and this pain in this life comes from this very profound and often unquestioned belief that we exist separate and independent from the rest of the universe. And we can go through our whole life feeling and believing and living this separation. And there is no blame here. But in the depths of that belief, it's perhaps somewhat inevitable that our primary concern in our life becomes our survival, the protection, and the enhancement of this isolated and separate self. We can feel to be one vulnerable and fragile self living in a world of many separate selves, not always benevolent. Sometimes we can compete with those other selves, sometimes we're anxious about them, sometimes we crave their attention. But we don't appreciate how our own vulnerability is also reflected in the countless beings around us. You know, a Christian mystic once said that anxiety is the mood of ignorance. That anxiety is the mood of feeling to be separate. That anxiety is the mood of feeling to be almost imprisoned within this isolated, separate self. And it can feel so difficult to embrace that anxiety, so instead we do what most beings do with anxiety, we get busy. You know, we live our lives, fill our lives with busyness or distractedness or layers of camouflage in a way to kind of protect this very vulnerable, fragile sense of isolated self. It's like Pablo Neruda, he said in his poem, part of his poem, Keeping Quiet, that if we were not so single-minded about keeping our lives moving and for once could do nothing, perhaps a huge silence might interrupt this sadness of not understanding ourselves and of threatening ourselves with death. Perhaps the earth can teach us, as when everything seems dead in winter and later proves alive. It is pretty obvious that the gap between, that seems to exist between self and other, I and you, us and them, inner and outer, that this gap is not something that is neutral or empty. We see it all around us in the world, this gap between I and you, us and them. This is the where hatred and anxiety and prejudice and fear live. Because our belief in the separated self essentially segregates us from the rest of the world. You know, we think of my body, my history, my family, my wants, my needs, my likes, my dislikes, etc., etc. We all know this story. And all that belongs to the territory of me and mine, separate from you and yours. Sometimes in harmony and sometimes in conflict. Sometimes we feel very fortunate to find other separated selves who we have things in common with. You know, the same football team or baseball team, you know, or the same likes and dislikes. It makes us not feel so alone. Now, I think that profound compassion really rests upon the commitment to understanding and to dissolving this almost invisible barrier that keeps us imprisoned and separated. Fortunately, delusion is not a life sentence. This is the good news. Delusion is not a life sentence. That we have the freedom to question. We have the freedom to investigate. We have the freedom to choose how we perceive ourselves and the world. Now, there are moments for all of us where we actually really do experience the falling away of that sense of separation. You know, in the 60s, people would take drugs endlessly just to get that one moment where there was the falling away of separation. But actually, we all experience moments when that sense of separation falls away, where there's that sense of heart opening, of embracing, where we could maybe look into the eyes of a homeless person or hear the anguish of a prisoner lost in a loveless world, or we just sense the frailty of an old person trying just to cross a road. And I think sometimes we can feel their pain in a quivering of our own hearts, in a quivering of our own hearts in response. And in this tradition, those moments of the falling away and that trembling and quivering of the heart is never meant to be something just left to chance, but actually cultivated. And that we can be actually, in truth, really quite relentless in questioning separation. We can, through meditation practice and through investigation, challenge the seemingly impenetrable veil of distance and disconnectedness. It's probably not enough just to want to feel compassion. It's certainly not enough not to just hold fine theories of emptiness. I think our longings really need to be translated translated into the language of direct understanding and embodiment. The capacity to listen to the cries of the world. The capacity to listen to the cries of the universe. This is the translation of Kuan Yin. Now, what does the sense of separation, isolation rest upon? You know, how do you get the story of me? How do we get the story of me? I mean, we weren't born with a story of me. We build a story of me. And the sense of isolation and separate self really rests upon our appearance, our bodies, our minds, our personality, our histories. This is the story of ourselves. Sometimes it seems such a long story that began before we were even born, and in truth it did. But we can also see that the story of me is something that's constantly being rewritten, isn't it? I mean, the story of me is rewritten through new experience, through new understandings. It's only when the story of me is unquestioned that it remains a kind of closed book, a finished manuscript. Then that's when we feel really imprisoned by our story. Our story can be written by what we cling to and identify with, or it can also be written by what we let go of and what we cultivate. When we think about how we define other selves, it's pretty much the same process, isn't it? I know you by your appearance, your body, your history, your beliefs, your opinions. Basically, I know you by how I think about you. Now, it's also true that sometimes we don't really want our stories to be challenged, because then who would we be? That's the dilemma we live with in our life. You know, we can feel parts, I mean, everybody likes parts of their stories, but very few people like the whole story. But that's the dilemma. We can feel imprisoned by a separate self, but we can be afraid of letting it go, because then who would we be? What would get us out of bed in the morning? You know, what would, you know, make us do anything in this life? And to tell you to... No. I'll tell you those two stories in a minute. We know some of the most, as relational beings, the most painful times in our lives are the times when there is the most conflict in relationship with others. When there is the most discord, the greatest sense of separation. Now, what does compassion mean in those moments? What does compassion mean in those moments? I think often what compassion asks of us is to learn really how to cross the borders of our own hearts and minds. I think compassion in those moments of conflict and discord is often asking us really to look at what we are clinging to. What is it that we are fearing? Again, Shantideva, he said, the mind does not find peace, nor does it enjoy pleasure or joy, nor does it find rest or courage, when the thorn of hatred dwells in the heart. In brief, there is nothing that can make an angry person happy. Unruly beings are like space. There's not enough time to overcome them. Uprooting our own anger is like defeating all our enemies. Now, our story can be written by clinging, but it can also be written by compassion, our willingness to embrace the causes of suffering. And when I speak about emptiness, I'm not talking about the annihilation of self. You know, I think too many people get into wrong view in this practice, you know, and they get into blaming self and thinking, you know, the solution to everything is to annihilate self. That's not the point of this practice, and that's not what understanding emptiness is. Of course, we all have a story in this life. Mine is different than yours. Yours is different than the person beside you. And our story is born of the conditions of our life, and our story is the vehicle through which we communicate everything, both lovely and unlovely. But there is a difference between knowing that story born of conditions and believing it to be the truth. One of my first teachers, Manindraji, he once said to me, "The thought of your mother is not your mother." I think that's very powerful. You know, it's like the thought of you is the thought of another, cannot possibly be them. The thought of myself is also not the truth of the whole story of who I can be. The thought of your mother is not your mother. And it's a real invitation to go beneath all those constructions we so easily get lost in and to ask, really, what is true? What can be understood? What can be connected with? Understanding our story lives in a state of potentiality. The potentiality for creating sorrow or the potentiality for evoking healing and joy. It is the falling away of the walls, the separations. You know, Milarepa, he once also said, he says, "Just as I instinctively reach out to care for and heal a wound in my leg as part of my body, why should I not reach out instinctively to heal and care for the wound of another wherever it exists as part of this body?" As part of this body. Now, cultivating compassion does not mean that we never feel angry or outrage or fearful. You know, if we encountered, and we do encounter, injustice and harshness and oppression and prejudice in this world, it doesn't actually help the world just to be noting it. Just to be noting it or just to be mindful. In fact, you know, the capacity sometimes to feel our hearts so disturbed in the face of injustice or oppression, that feeling is actually the quivering and the beginning of compassion. You know, the Dalai Lama once said that anger in the face of the unjust can be the forerunner of powerful, altruistic gestures of healing. Probably not something you expected the Dalai Lama to say. But we need to be touched deeply. And that touching, and sometimes it comes in the form of a kind of unease. It carries with it the energy to awaken us. Now that energy can be channeled into harm or into understanding, into perpetuating sorrow or into healing it. And this is the fearlessness of compassion. Because none of us can choose whether or not to engage with the world we're part of. We can only choose how we engage. And compassion does ask us to be engaged in every moment. To know when the empathy and stillness and receptivity of compassion is called for. Sometimes we just need to know how to be still in the face of and in the midst of profound suffering. And sometimes we also need to know how to reach out and how to be fearless. In our acts and our words and our choices, when to say no with wisdom. when we are called upon to protect the well-being of ourselves and others, it's not always heroic gestures. Sometimes it is just moving a small creature from the road. Compassion is never measured by the worthiness of an act, but by the capacity to respond. So a beautiful poem I came across some time ago. It says, "The old man must have stopped our car 24 times to climb out and gather into his hands the small toads blinded by our lights and leaping like drops of rain. The rain was falling a mist about his white hair, and I kept saying, 'You can't save them all. Accept it. Get back in. We've got places to go.' But leathery hands full of wet brown life, knee-deep in the summer roadside grass, he just smiled and said, 'They have places to go too.'" Just as compassion doesn't measure the worth of any act or response in relationship to suffering, neither does compassion make a hierarchy out of suffering. I know some people feel that because of their own story or history that they feel somehow unworthy or undeserving or unlovable. Undeserving of attention, they make a hierarchy out of suffering. And they look at the immensity of pain in some people's lives and feel it's somehow, you know, selfish or self-indulgent to care for their own ailing body or their broken heart or their obsessive mind. But compassion, I think, doesn't have any hierarchies or boundaries. And it's almost as if we don't know the way or the path to tend to the pain in our own lives the moment it arises, how would we ever imagine we would find the patience and steadfastness to listen to the cries of the world? I think as human beings, we are probably most endangered by our unwillingness to listen to pain and understand it. Because if we ignore pain, then we smother our capacity for compassion and for healing. Now, this teaching teaches us not so much just to awaken for ourselves, but really to participate in the awakening of life. To be a participant in the awakening of life. You know, and I know many of you who've practiced really know that mindfulness is a way of caring for the world. It is a way of saying that everything matters. Everything is worthy of our attention. And it is a beginning. It is a beginning of the cultivation of compassion. It is the beginning of the understanding of emptiness. It is the beginning of healing. And I think it is the beginning of understanding what it means to participate in the awakening.